Today's Teisho will be on Case 20 in the Momonkan, the Umenkwan. Case 20 is entitled, A Man of Great Strength. Shogen Osho asked, why is it that a man of great strength does not lift his legs? And he also said, it is not the tongue he speaks with. Mumon's comment, it must be said that Shogen shows us all his stomach and intestines, but alas, no one can appreciate him. And even if someone could appreciate him, let him come to me and I'll beat him severely. Why? If you want to find pure gold, you must see it through fire. Mumon's verse, lifting his leg, he kicks up the scented ocean. Lowering his head, he looks down on the fourth jhana heaven. There is no space vast enough for his body. Now, somebody write the last line here. Thank you all very much for coming to practice Zen this morning, this late summer morning. I have an addiction, and I don't know what to do about it. I am addicted to online news. NPR. Every once in a while, I'll meet somebody who is as addicted to NPR as I am. A few months ago, I went to visit some friends of mine, Dawn and Dawn Skorchevsky and her husband, Lou. Louis is also totally addicted to NPR. And we were just talking about how many times a day we listen to NPR, driving to work, at lunch, and so on. And also, I am addicted to Huffington Post and things like that. So I read a lot of news, and I have to exercise great care, because if you want to bum yourself out, one thing you can do is get up in the morning and read the news, you know. It's like the anti-Zen, you know. So I strongly recommend that you not do that. I recommend that you get up. And really, I'm really being serious, you know. If you get up in the morning and you read the Huffington Post, and then you read Alternet, and then you read Truthdig, you're either outraged or you're ready to jump out a window by the time you're done. So it would be good not to start your day like that. It would be good to get up, have a cup of tea, sit down, and do some zazen. Not everybody has time for this kind of a schedule. I know many people have to get to the subway, I mean get to the train, and then get to New York and get to the subway. I'm lucky because I live about half an hour from where I work. So if I get up early, I have time to do some zazen. And it's really wonderful because when you get up in the morning, your mind is rather gentle, rather soft and gentle. And there's not a lot of activity. And when you sit down on the cushion, it can feel really wonderful. I feel when I sit down in the morning to do zazen that the whole world is like open or embracing me, or it's waiting for me to arrive. It's an odd feeling, but I feel that morning sit is so precious because it's as though there's a kind of rapport between myself and the world right there. It's like connection or rapport. I don't know how to put it, but it's like the world is beckoning or waiting for me to arrive. And then I start doing my zazen, and I feel very much a part of this morning that's unfolding. And that's a much better way to start the day than to sit and read Alternet and about the crooks in Washington and so on. So please exercise some control and try not to read the newspapers first thing in the morning. I do read a lot of news all the same, and it does distress me, you know. It does upset me. The other day I was reading something about President Obama, and it was in a foreign policy. It was actually in the American Prospect. I don't know if you know that magazine, but it's a progressive magazine, progressive magazine. And I have read it for many years. I used to get the paper version, but now I read it online. And there was an article about Obama that was very critical of Obama, and it was, I think it was titled, Obama, the Zen President. And when I saw that, I thought, you know, I thought instantly, uh-oh. And I read the article, and it was quite critical of Obama. And at the end, I thought, you know, I thought, I don't know if this is fair or not to Obama, but it's definitely not fair to Zen. Because basically it was saying that Mr. Obama is somebody who has no clear agenda. And by the way, I'm not endorsing these views. I voted for Obama. And I was elated when he became president. And I have been very unhappy with the way politics are going in Washington, you know. But the article said basically that Mr. Obama was somebody who has no clear agenda or no clear commitments. He, you know, if you want him to say the sky is blue, he'll say the sky is blue. If it's appropriate for him to say the sky is gray, he'll say the sky is gray. And they talked about how when he ran for office, he would say, we need to protect the environment. And then when he was president, you know, he didn't really go forward with the clean enforcement of some Clean Air Acts. Legislation. And they went through case after case where on one time Obama says yes, at another time to the same question he says no. And they painted a picture of him as like a chameleon-like figure, you know, or inscrutable. So you can never know what's going on inside Mr. Obama, because he's always covered up or veiled or very carefully concealing himself. And so he seems contradictory all the time. He seems to be, when he's with people who like ice cream, he likes ice cream. When he's with people who don't like ice cream, he doesn't like ice cream, and so on. And so they said Obama is the Zen president because he seems to be totally free from any strong beliefs or any strong commitments. And he seems to be a vacillating person. So he'll make a promise, and then with another group he'll make the opposite promise. And when I read the article, I actually felt that it was speaking about something very important. You know, this is not about politics, but when I voted for Mr. Obama, I thought he was going to be a very strong progressive leader like Franklin Roosevelt, whom I admire greatly. In my grandparents' house, on the wall of their house, there was a picture of Franklin Roosevelt. They had lived through the worst years of the Depression. And for my grandfather, Roosevelt was like a god almost. He just thought Roosevelt could do no wrong. And I must say, I really admired Roosevelt because he really was a fighter for ordinary people. And he created jobs for people when the economy was bad, and he created really the social safety net we have now. He was apparently a very compassionate person, I would say. You know. And so when I voted for Obama, I thought Obama was going to be a fighter like Roosevelt for the little guy, and he was going to push back against the very powerful people who control finances and government, the legislature, and so on. And he was going to really help us in a time of crisis. And the article said, you know, Obama hasn't done those things. He doesn't apparently believe enough in, say, his ideas that he put forward during the campaign to actually act on them, you know. And then they talked about the fact he seemed incapable of acting a lot of the time. He seemed to be paralyzed and unable to communicate. So, you know, I thought at the end of the article that this was pretty much of a beating up of Mr. Obama. And I was a little bit, I was somewhat in agreement with some of the points it made. But I was really not happy with the way it represented Zen. Because it sort of suggested that the Zen is all about not really believing in anything and basically being sort of chameleon-like. And also that Zen is really, that Zen people are sort of vacillating, you know, sort of vacillating people who, you know, basically are incapable of action because they're sort of up on a mountaintop meditating. This is one of the things they sort of said about Obama, that he takes the long view, he takes the high ground, he has sort of his nose in the air. And because he's so big-minded, he doesn't get down in the dirt and fight it out, you know, and so nothing gets accomplished. So there was this also this accusation that Mr. Obama was like, you know, like a Zen monk living high in the mountains, aloof from all human concerns, you know. Now, they really didn't talk about Zen in the article, but it did bug me all the same. And then later, about 3 weeks later, I read something again where they were talking about Mr. Obama with the writer was talking about Mr. Obama with great frustration that he wasn't acting. And it wasn't Paul Krugman, but it was somebody very much like that. I think it was, it might even be Robert Reich. But he said, as usual, Obama is inscrutable, the Zen man. And I just, come on, you know, this is so unfair. Again, I don't know if it's unfair to Obama, but I thought it was unfair to Zen. Because what we're doing is not really about being so removed from things that we don't have to be concerned about them. It's not really about having no commitments, or being so detached that we just blow this way and that way, you know. So if the wind's blowing east, we go east. If the wind's blowing west, we go west. You know, you accommodate yourself to the circumstance. You make yourself comfortable. You say the right thing. And this is, and you stay mentally sort of like on a mountaintop. You know, this is sort of the implication. So I think this is a kind of an unfair representation of Zen. But I think probably even people who practice Zen might not understand fully, you know, what we're up to, you know, what Zen is all about, because there are these stories of people who act very crazily and spontaneously. You know, there's a famous story about a teacher who puts a bottle on the floor, and he said, "I want somebody to tell me what this is." And one student says, "It's a bottle." And the teacher says, "That's not a good answer." And another student says, "It's not a bottle." And the teacher says, "Oh, that's even worse." So finally, one student just comes over and kicks it over with his foot, and the teacher's delighted. Right? And you think, what is that all about? You know? There's another Zen story about a great Zen master named Nansen, who comes into the Zen hall with a cat. And he said, "If one of you can say a Zen word, if you can respond now at this moment with some word of Zen, I'll spare the cat. But if you can't respond, I'll cut the cat in half." And nobody can respond, and he cuts that cat in half. Later, his main student Joshu comes back. And Joshu and Nansen says, "Oh, I'm so sorry I killed that cat. What would you have done?" And Nansen puts his shoe on his head and goes through the door backwards. You know, these kinds of stories suggest that there's a Zen way of being, you know, but we don't really know what it is. You know, we can read a lot of books on Zen and still not understand what it is. And it's possible to think, you know, Zen is about having no beliefs, going with the flow, being like water. You know, if the water flows west, you flow west. When the ground slopes east, you flow east. You know, and this sort of thing, and always being aloof, always being detached. You know, so global warming, detached. You know. It is true that you can get involved in things in a way that's really, it's true that detachment is not Zen. But on the other hand, you know, it's also true that there's a way of living which is not detached, it's attached in a really unhealthy way, you know. So it is possible to get up in the morning and to have a nice cup of coffee and sit down and read the Huffington Post and read first article, and you read it, and it's about how all of these bankers have gotten away with no punishment for their misdeeds. And you can feel your anger rising, you know. You can feel frustration, anger. And then you can read another article, and it will be about how the oil companies are thwarting attempts to pass new legislation. And then you can feel your blood pressure rising, you know. And then you read something about how evangelicals are denying global warming, and they all said at the Republican National Convention that global warming was a fantasy. Now you can be really agitated. You could go through the whole day like that, you know, clinging to these things that are very upsetting. And you might find that when you leave the house, you're already for a fight. You know, so maybe somebody has cut you off in traffic and you just feel like honking the horn, you know, at the whole Republican Party or something like that. You know. So that kind of attachment is very unhealthy indeed. And it seems like it's either that kind of attachment, or you want to have that. You want to be on the mountaintop. It's just like, calm down, you know, let it go, don't worry. You know, that seems like Zen. You know, but actually, I think that's a big. That's sort of what the writers of these articles were thinking about Zen. Zen's all about being aloof, being detached, not getting caught up in the fight down below, you know, staying on the mountaintop. But that's a real misunderstanding of Zen. You know, I really like this koan. It's so simple. But Shogen Osho said, why is it that a man of great strength cannot lift his legs? You know, this is such a wonderful koan, because if you think about it, a lot of the time we feel this way. You know, we feel this way. It's like you have no ability to act. You know, you have no ability to act. You feel paralyzed or trapped, or like you can't make anything happen in life. This is I think a lot of people have this feeling, right? That things are unfolding around them, and they need to act, but they can't act. I think this is sort of what this koan is about. A person of great strength, you're sort of, in a certain way, you're a person of great strength, but you can't act. You know, you feel, I think this is what upsets us so much about the world we live in, you know, is that there are all these problems that we want to do something, or we want something to get done, but we feel somehow that we can't act. And I don't think it's just our circumstances, you know. I think inside of ourselves we feel blocked a lot of the time, blocked. I hope that's making some sense. You know, I think people often feel unable to act, or unable to act freely in the world, to be freely moving through the world. Often I think we do things in a very hesitating way, you know. So a problem arises and you think, you send your child to school, and maybe you have a son and you send your son to school, and he's liking school for a while. But then one day he comes home and looks very sad, and you say to your son, what's wrong? And he said, I don't want to go to school tomorrow. And you, what? I thought you liked school. And after a while you talk to your son, and it turns out that basically somebody roughed him up, another boy pushed him around on the playground, you know. So then you say, you know, you think, what'll I do? You know, I could go down to the school and talk to the teacher and say, I want you to make sure my son doesn't get beaten up on the playground. You know, that's very bad for him. You could do that, or you could call. You could find out who the kid is. You know, you could find out who the kid is. You could call his mother or his father and say, look, you know, see here, you know, this is wrong. You know, I want you to make sure your son keeps his hands off my son. But then you think to yourself, but look, doesn't he have to stick up? He has to learn how to stick up for himself, you know. And so, you know, then you might lie there at night and think, okay, should I call the teacher? Should I call the parent? Should I let him work it out himself, you know? Maybe I should take him to karate class, you know. But then I might, you know, okay, so maybe you're going to take him to a karate class, but then he might become a bully, you know. So what'll I do, you know? I think this is very common human experience, you know. We want to do the right thing, and we begin to think about all the ways we can act, you know. And the more we think about them, you know, I don't know if this is true for you, but, you know, for me, sometimes I find myself weighing each of these options, and they all seem very good. You know, they all seem like, this is a good idea. And then you look at the next one, and you think, this is a good idea. You know, I'll call the parent, you know. Probably the parent will be reasonable and say, what? my son, you know, beat your son up on the playground, that's terrible. I don't want to raise a bully. But then on the other hand, you know, you could talk to the person, he could be rude and nasty himself and say, well, you know, you better teach your kid to stick up for himself. You know, that might work and it might not. You know, letting your own child work it out for himself, maybe he'll get beaten up every day. You know, his grades might go down, that would affect his future. You could teach him to box, you know, maybe that would work. But maybe he'll become a bully. You know, so you think about each of these steps and they all seem compelling. You know, that can happen to you. Or sometimes, you know, you have a problem and every one of the options looks bad. I'm sure you've had that sort of situation where, you know, if I do this, that's going to come at a heavy price. If I do that, that's, you know, a friend of mine has just been going through a divorce, you know. He was very unhappy for a number of years. You know, we would sometimes have lunch together and he would tell me about his troubles. And he hadn't been able, he and his partner, his wife, hadn't been able to work it out. And they went to the therapy, and that helped for a little while, but they just couldn't get it together. And my friend was very unhappy in his marriage. And then he got divorced, and of course he was very unhappy to be divorced, you know. So it wasn't like he got out of his marriage and thought, oh, I'm free, you know. Now he's lonely. You know, so it was like he wasn't lonely, but he was miserable. And now he's not miserable in that way, but he's lonely. Right? So it's like, you go this way, you're in this kind of a bind. You go this way, you're in this, you know. So life has this character of being, you know, sometimes all the options look equally good, but the risks are high. You think, I don't want to screw my son up. You know, I want him to be happy. I want him to be confident. You know, I don't want him to be feel like a loser. You know, so I can't let him get beaten up on the playground. What'll I do? And you can go to Barnes and Noble, and you can get a book on parent, you know, what to do when your child is beaten up on the playground, you know, and you can read it. But it might, you know, even that probably doesn't give you like a sure answer. Or you could follow it, and it could not work out very well, you know. So you can look for authorities to help you, but the truth is that life has this character of being like open-ended. You know, you look and there's four different paths you could take. You can't walk down all of them. And you've got to choose, but you don't know which one to choose. And sometimes they all look good, possibly, and sometimes they all look bad. You know, I think this is, you know, maybe this is what Mr. Obama's been going through, you know. So you know, I think we all go through this. It's easy to look at Mr. Obama and say, well, if I were Obama, I'd know exactly what to do. But it's probably not true. You know, you'd probably be in the same set of dilemmas, right? If I do this, you know, Wall Street will be unhappy and the stock market will plunge. If I do this, you know, the housing market will stay depressed and there'll be no jobs and... So anyway, you know, we all are in this situation where we have to choose, but there's high levels of uncertainty and no guarantees, and there's lots of risk for us and for other people we love and care about. You know? So this is the sort of like human experience, right? You know, I think, one element of it. It's possible to think that Zen is like about who cares, man? You know, that kind of thing. You know, that Zen is aloof. You know, when I don't have to choose any of these. You know, I don't have to choose. Let it flow. You know, okay, but what are you going to do with your kid tomorrow if he goes to the playground and gets beaten up? You have to choose. You know, you have to choose. You know, you can't be aloof when it's your kid. You love your kid, don't you? You know, You can't go with the flow because there's four different flows, see? And so what do you do? Actually, Zen is not about refusing to choose or refusing to act. Zen is very interested in the way we feel paralyzed when we have to act, see? And it's very interested in helping us to act freely and effectively and with great energy and even like joy, you know. So what we tend to do when we're in that situation where we have to choose is we can freeze, right? And we go over things obsessively, you know. When I had very strict parents. My parents were incredibly strict. And I actually wasn't allowed to date girls until I got to college and I was out of the house, you know. And when I was in college, I would see a girl in class and I would think maybe I would approach her and ask her, you know, like, would you like to have a cup of coffee with me, or would you, you know? But I would be paralyzed by anxiety and also thinking, you know, she'll say no, she won't like me, you know. And so I'd want to act, but I couldn't act, you know. I didn't dare to act, you know. This is so human, right? You know, the choices look bad, the choices are scary. If we choose this, we might have to pay a heavy price. Someone we love might have to pay a heavy price, you know. So we can go through life constantly feeling like this, the man of great strength who can't lift his leg, you know. I know I'm strong, but I can't lift my leg. This feeling, I think, is very familiar to all of us, you know. Or at least it's familiar to me. So how do we act? You know, this idea that we just go with the flow is, I think, as we used to say, bullshit. You know? Because you can't just go with the flow. Are you going to, when you go to the ballot, when you go to vote for the next president, you know, it could be Rick Perry, it could be Obama. I'm not telling you how to vote, but you might not vote, and that's a choice. And you might vote, and you might vote for Obama, and you might vote for Rick Perry, but if you don't vote, you know, you're going to have to live with the consequences. So this is not about politics, but it's about life, you know. You can't just go, I'll go with the flow. Well, please. But what does that mean when you go into the ballot box, you know, you go into the voting booth, rather? You know, which lever are you going to pull? And you can think about it and think about it and think about it. Lie abed at night and think, what? I he's getting beaten up on the playground. I've got to do something. Which of these will I choose? And also, you know, it's not just the uncertainty of it all. It's that we carry a lot of baggage with us, you know, a lot of psychological baggage with us. So sometimes our situation is complicated because we are haunted by mental ghosts, you know. Nobody just makes a choice. When we come to a crossroads in life, we bring with us all of these unconscious tendencies, all of these unconscious baggage, right? And it can affect us in various ways. You know, some people some people, when they're at a crossroads, build up a lot of tension. You know, when you have to choose and you don't know how to choose, sometimes people build up a lot of tension, and sometimes they do things that are very reckless in order to release that tension, you know. I was hiking this summer with my friend Larry, and his sister-in-law was the town business manager for one of these towns out in eastern Oregon. And she had a degree in accounting. And she was very good with money and managing the city's money. But she developed, after a divorce, she developed a gambling addiction. And Larry and his wife, Pat, were shocked to discover that she was thousands and thousands of dollars in hock because of her. She had really basically gambled away her retirement. And she couldn't stop, you know. And you think, why doesn't she stop? You know, it's common sense. You don't bet, you don't gamble away your retirement. She, you know, that's what people have these compulsions where they feel this internal pressure building up. And the only way they can get rid of the internal pressure is to do this thing, which may be very destructive, but they can't help themselves because it's better to gamble than to feel that internal pressure, you know, which comes from maybe things you haven't worked out in your life. So gambling makes you feel better right away. But then, of course, the real problems you haven't dealt with come back and you build up that pressure again, and then you have to gamble, see. So some of our actions are really based upon like these ghosts we carry with us. And also sometimes we don't have compulsions like that that make us act. We have compulsions that keep us from acting. So, you know, for example, when I was about 12, I was really a scrawny and I would say unattractive. And I was very uncoordinated. When I got older, I actually got better. I practiced basketball. I actually became a decent basketball player. But when I was about 12, I was like very awkward and people would, like, I was the guy who would come up to bat. We'd be playing high school softball. And I'd strike out every time. And I was the guy who would shoot the hoop, never get the ball through the hoop, right? So I used to be in a situation, maybe this happened to you, maybe it didn't, but when I was in high school, we would go out on the court, during gym. And we might be playing basketball, we might be playing something else, and baseball, softball. And they'd choose up sides, you know. I'm sure people still do this. They'd be two captains, and they'd say, "I'll take Bill. I'll take Tom. I'll take Sam. I'll take," you know. I would be in the group that was still not taken, right? By the end, you know. And it's like, well, who's going to take Kurt? You know. Well, I had him last time, you know. Like, you get him this time, right? It's like, oh, thanks. You know, I'm sitting there wishing I could sink into the ground, you know. So, anyway, when I was 6 years older, or 7 years older, and I'm in college, and I see this girl, and I think, maybe I should ask her out, right? Why do I freeze? Because I'm still 12 years old, and I'm on the basketball court, and nobody wants to take me, see? So I'm going to say, would you like to go out? And she's going to say, of course not. You're the loser. Nobody would, you know, take it in the basketball game. So that's a burden, right? That's a burden. So, you know, this is really what this koan is about, right? We have to make choices where the options can all be equally good, but the risks are high, or the options all look equally bad. And we might have a compulsion that makes us do things that we know are destructive to ourselves, you know. Sometimes people have they're so afraid of rejection that they actually become aggressive, you know. So they'll be carrying a conversation with somebody and they'll sort of needle the other person. And later you say, why did I do that? Why did I needle that person? And it's because I wanted them to like me so much, I decided to end the pressure by making them not like me. And then it was over and I could relax, right? I mean, this is a typical sort of behavior. And then later you think, why did I do that? You know, I wanted that person to be my friend. So anyway, Zen is not about hanging aloof, and it's not about living on a mountaintop, and it's not about going with the flow. You know, that's too simple-minded. Zen is about living in this world where we have to make choices in a high-risk environment. We don't want people to be hurt. And we have ghosts that we carry with us, you know. And we have to act. Zen is all about having to act. Zen is all about, like, acting. How do we act? What do we do? See. And so, you know, you can say, but, you know, we sit on a cushion. You know, we come in here and we sit on a cushion for 3 hours, or we sit on a cushion for an hour. 2 hours. How is that acting? Well, I mean, what we're doing is cultivating a kind of mind that is basically not so afraid, not so limited, and we're developing a kind of trust, trusting mind, right? When we start every day at Sesshin, we recite the verses on the heart mind, and we want to be one with the trusting mind. Right? It's so hard to trust, but you know, when you act from a place of fear, that's actually doing things out of fear is usually the worst choice you can make. And let me say from personal experience that when you make a decision out of fear, usually you regret that decision. Even if it brings you safety, you'll be unhappy with. Acting from fear is a kind of compulsion, compulsive action, and it's almost always going to lead to unhappiness. Usually it leads to a sense of deadness or inner lifelessness, alienation, this kind of thing, feeling very... You know, so acting from fear is usually like the worst thing you can do. Usually, if you act from a place that's trusting, usually the results are much better. You know, it's usually much better. I've told this story before, but... G.U. Kennett was an Anglican minister. She was the first woman, ordained woman in Great Britain, in the Anglican Church. So she was a very unusual person. She was really a courageous, intelligent person. She wanted to be a minister, and they told her, no, you can't be a minister. Women can't be ministers. But she said, let's see. And she went to theology school, and she got her degree, and she, you know, and they actually ordained her. And then she decided she wasn't happy with the spirituality of her confession, her faith. And she went to Japan and studied in a Soto monastery. And all the monks hated her. They hated her because she was white. They hated her because she was a woman. They hated her because she was, for those reasons, threatening and intelligent, and so on and so on. So they would try to trip her up. You know, so somebody would say, don't worry, I'll wake you up in time for the sutra recitation. And then they wouldn't wake her up, and she'd be late. And she'd have to come into the Zen hall late and look like a fool. And the master would scowl at her. Or somebody would say, here, I'll show you how to rake the gravel, and they'd show her the wrong way, and then later she'd get bawled out by the boss of the yard, you know. And this kept going on and on. People kept trying to mess with her mind, and she got very discouraged, and she went in to see the teacher, and the teacher said, look, you know, you need to respond to all this in a different way. Everything that happens is helping you wake up. See, this is like, he says, have a trusting mind. Have a trusting mind. Everything that's happening is helping you wake up, which is true. And she kept saying to herself, everything that's happening is helping me wake up. Everything. And so all of these things became, like, instead of like threatening events, they became gifts. And she kept responding to these things in this trusting, positive way. And of course, she finished her training. She became this guy's Dharma heir. She went back to California. And she was just getting her community really going, Mount Shasta, Shasta Abbey. And she developed a health problem. She went to the doctor, and the doctor said, you have about 6 months to live. And she lived about 18 years later, longer than that. But, you know, the doctor said, you're going to die in 6 months. You know, you better, you know, get your affairs in order. And basically, she lived another 18 years just on trust, right? Just on trust. Every day she got up and thinking, this could be the last day. You know, it's possible to be absolutely paralyzed by that. But if you ask me what we're doing on the cushion, we're cultivating trust. Now, you know, you can't just sit there and say, trust, trust, trust. You know, you have to experience the world as trustworthy, you know. And that's actually what we're doing. We're experiencing the world again and again as trustworthy. You know, often people feel very alienated from the world, very separate. You know, our mental habits make us feel separate. You come in to the Zendo and you've had a rough week. You know, maybe there's been conflict in your home or at work. You know, your nerves are on edge. Maybe you're defensive. You know, you can feel the tension. You know, you feel separate. You know, separate. I went through a period in my life recently at work where there was a lot of conflict. And I was really having a lot of unpleasant experiences with people. And I must say, I don't think it was my fault at all. But people around me were sort of like having a lot of problems that they were, you know, inflicting on other people. And it created all this disharmony. And I remember I had this dream where I was in my house and people were trying to break into my house, you know, and they were like zombies or something. And I had a gun and I was shooting them, you know, but I'd shoot them and they wouldn't die. You know, I don't think any real bullets came out. I think I looked at the gun and there were no bullets coming out of the gun. Well, this dream is obvious, right? It's like, I felt like I was besieged from all sides, right? And that I had no weapon to deal with it, right? But, you know, when you get up, you take a shower, you go to work, but the zombies are still trying to get into your house, you know, under the surface of your consciousness. So basically, you know, you sit down on the cushion and your nerves are jangled and you're feeling defensive. And, you know, you think, why did I even come to sit, you know? You watch your breath, and you watch your breath, and eventually you begin to feel, you know, you have a deep relaxation response, which is a very good thing, and your blood pressure goes down, your heart rate goes down. And then, you know, you might just stumble into samadhi. All of a sudden you feel better, you feel okay, you know, I feel okay. And then you might even begin to feel really good. You know, you get this sense of like safety or well-being. And you begin to feel, you know, connected. You know, you finish two periods of meditation or three periods of meditation, somebody serves the tea and you think, oh my God, this tea is fantastic, you know. Or you go outside and you see the moon and you think, oh, it's not so bad. Things aren't so bad. You know, what just happened was, you know, you connect with the world. You know, we're pulling back, pulling back, pulling back, pulling back. and you get onto the cushion and you connect with the world, and you feel suddenly the renewal of trust. So the renewal of trust. And then you feel like, I can handle this, you know. I can handle this. Yeah, this is really very much what Zen is about. Zen is not about not choosing. Because there's no way not to choose in life. You've got to choose. You've got to choose. Even not choosing is a choice. You know, but you can't hang back on the mountaintop. That's not Zen. Zen is about choosing, about acting from this place of trust. See, so you say, well, what'll I do? My kid is getting beaten up on the playground. What'll I do? You know, and there's nobody on heaven and earth who can tell you what the right thing to do is. There's no answer waiting for you. You know, life is really open-ended. It's really open-ended. If you take your son to karate, he could get injured. He could become a bully, you know. He could become a Navy SEAL, you know. You never know, right? Right? If you call the parents, you know, actually you could call a parent and that person could become your best friend. And 6 months later, the two kids would be playing in the backyard instead of hitting each other. That could happen. You know, so it's an open-ended universe. And so trying to find the right answer, try to think it through, is probably futile. But the worst thing you can do is act from fear. When you act from fear, the results are usually terrible results. And you become a prisoner of your fear. You know, I mean, I know this from personal experience. You know, Zen has helped me so much to work through my own fears, you know. Acting from fear is, generally speaking, a terrible mistake, although we all make terrible mistakes. But when we sit down on the cushion and we get into this connected mindset that feels safety and well-being, you begin to be generous, you feel generous, you feel, I can handle it. See, this is what Zen is all about. When you act from this place, everything is much more likely to work out. You see, it's a better decision, no matter what happens, because you're now not a prisoner of your fear. You're not a prisoner, right? I mean, everybody makes, quote-unquote, mistakes, right? So if you're trying to avoid mistakes, you might as well just jump into the ground right now and pull the grass up over you. Because there's no way to live without mistakes, right? But the thing is, maybe we could live, like, you know, openly, with joy, and so on and so on. And that sounds wonderful. That's what Zen is all about. You know, so we all feel sometimes like the man of great strength who can't lift his leg. You know, I can't lift my leg. And we act and we second guess ourselves and so on. But Zen is really all about tapping into that sense of trust and connectedness, you know. And when we find that, you know, that's when we find that on the cushion, we get off the cushion and we can go out and we can do things. When we act from this place of trust, everything is much better. Shogen Osho said, "Why is it that a man of great strength cannot lift his legs?" He also said, "It is not the tongue he speaks with." Mumon's verse. See, I mean, when we feel like when we act from fear, we feel that nothing we do is going to work. It's like we feel paralyzed, and when we act from fear, it's, you know, desperate. But when we find that connected place, when we act from trust, it's like the whole universe, it's like everything is helping us to wake up. Mumon's verse, lifting his leg, He kicks the ocean up. I kick the ocean with my one leg. Lowering his head, he looks down on the fourth jhana heaven. In other words, when you have that trust, it's like you're higher than heaven. I can handle it. I can handle it. And then you feel the whole universe is unfolding with you. This is a Zen action. There is no space vast enough for his body. See? That's trust. He says, now somebody write the last line here. See, in other words, now it's time for you to act. Don't worry about getting it wrong. Just find that place of trust and then just act.